Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as The News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number, the title track from the Grammy Award-winning album, The Suburbs, Arcade Fire. We'll be hearing more about and from Arcade Fire later on in today's program, and they'll close it out as well. This was recommended to us, and it's dedicated to Ryan Boyd. Thank you, Ryan. Our trivia questions come to us today from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, plunges into music from 2007. Question number one, which one of the following is not an actual song title? Is it A, Mama, Get a Hammer, There's a Fly on Papa's Head? Or is it B, Rednecks, White Sox, and Blue Ribbon Beer? Or is it C, She Got the Gold Mine, I Got the Shaft? Or is it D, Dropkick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life? Or is it E, If You See Me Getting Smaller, It's 'Cause I'm Leaving You? Or is it F, all of the above are actual country song titles? And question number two, in 1976, Rick Dees was a Memphis disc jockey during the height of the disco fad. Inspired by a friend who did wonderful impersonations, Dees wrote a novelty song about a man who goes to a disco party and dances so hard that he turns into what? A, a frog. B, a superhero. C, a duck. D, a woman. Or E, John Travolta. Hint, here's a snippet from that song.
Party the other night, all the ladies were treating me right. Moving my feet to the disco beat. How in the world could I keep my seat?
So what did he turn himself into? He danced so hard. The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section for today's program is brought to us by the series Today in Music History, and today is the weekend of July 15 and 16. These are brought to us by www.musicorb.com and bgorecords.com. If you were born on July 15th, you share a birthday with Federico Davia, the opera singer, born on that day, July 15th, 1933. Also, Linda Ronstadt was born on July 15th, You're No Good, from 1946. And David Pack of Ambrosia, born on July 15th, 1952. And you also share a birthday with Joe Satriani, 1956, July 15th. Or if you were born on July 16th, you share a B-Day with Fritz Mahler, the composer. He was born on July 16th, 1901. Ginger Rogers, born on July 16th, 1911. John Chilton, jazz trumpeter, July 16th, 1932. Pinchas Zukerman, the violinist, born on July 16th, 1948. And Stuart Copeland, the police, born on July 16th, 1952. Deaths in music history on July 15th. Well, Julia Lennon, mother of Beatle John, dies in an auto accident back in 1958 on the July 15th. And Harry Chapin, the folk vocalist, dies in a car crash at 38 years old on July 16th, 1981. Miscellany in music history this weekend, well, you may remember back in 1795 it was Marseillaise becoming the French national anthem. And if you don't remember that, how about this? 1954, Traineers record Say Hey, the Willie Mays song. This was produced by 21-year-old Quincy Jones back in 1954 this weekend. Back in 1966 this weekend, it was Percy Sledge earning a gold disc for When a Man Loves a Woman. And that same year, Tommy James hits number one with Hanky Panky this weekend. And back in 1966, the same weekend, Eric Clapton, Ginger Baker, and Jack Bruce formed the group Cream. Back in 1967, a year after that this weekend, it was Van Morrison scoring his first solo hit with Brown Eyed Girl. And back in 1986, Dolly Parton's theme park, Dollywood, opens in Tennessee. Finally, back in 1973, this weekend, it was Bob Dylan releasing Knockin' on Heaven's Door as part of the Billy the Kid soundtrack.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
And in local rock news, we see this article, They Just Don't Stop Jamming, by Ed Condren, News and Observer, July 8, 2011. OAR is like a musical shark. It just keeps on moving. The freewheeling jam band is always working on a project. Last night at the Raleigh Amphitheater and Festival site, OAR previewed tracks from its forthcoming release, King, which drops in August. That will make 6 studio albums and 4 official live releases in 14 years. Not bad production. That's the way we are, drummer Chris Koulos says. We've been hard-working guys since we were kids. Most of us grew up in Rockville, Maryland, and have been in bands since middle school. We started playing together in my mom's basement and never stopped, and that's practically literal. OAR has made some impressive earnest lush pop rock since it emerged more than a decade ago, but the best way to get OAR is to check out the group live. We've always been about playing in front of a crowd, Koulos says. We love the live experience. Our fans are very enthusiastic about what we do live, so we play out often, and we tend to release quite a few live albums. What's refreshing about OAR is that it keeps moving in different sonic directions. We haven't made the same studio album over and over. We've done different things, which has been great for us creatively. But we're living in an interesting time right now. The music industry is in its 1950 mode. It's all about the singles format. I don't know where we fit with that. I try not to think about it. We'll continue to make albums, live albums, and of course, we'll tour.
Am I coming on way too strong? I scared you off, never met nobody who had me from the first hello. Then oh, you really got me going. I'm working on a brighter day. I hope I don't scare you away. Let me give you some free advice. Never listen to a word I say, because I'm taking on the world today. You're by my side, it helps to be crazy. Taking on the world today. Hey, hey. Hey, hey.
This is OAR with their hit, Taking on the World Today. Always on the road, OAR has built much of its audience by touring relentlessly. Its worth ethic is right up there with its acclaimed jams. Nothing has come easy for us. We've worked very hard ever since the band formed. But it's been a relatively quick run up the ladder for OAR, which has scaled some enviable heights. It took OAR just 4 years from playing its first Manhattan gig at the Village Underground to headlining Madison Square Garden. It's been a pretty quick climb, but we've earned it. It wasn't like we went from American Idol to Madison Square Garden. We did it on our own. We didn't have a television show or radio play help us get there. We've just worked so hard for it. But today, I think that's the way bands have to do it. You've got to really want it to succeed. in this business.
For everything to fall in place, we wait. All we love are things that we can't figure out, and I'm about to make a change.
This next article was published online on April the 5th, 2011, entitled Dinner with the In-Laws: Why Does Knowing How Long a Bad Experience Will Last Make It Worse? Knowing how long a good experience will last makes it better, but being aware of the duration of an unpleasant event makes it worse, according to a new study in the Journal of Consumer Research. But people usually predict the opposite effect. Which is more enjoyable, knowing the exact duration of a dinner with a charming friend or not knowing it? What if the dinner is with disliked in-laws, asked authors Min Zhao and Claire I. Tsai, University of Toronto. People often assume that knowing the duration of a pleasant event will kill the fun, whereas knowing the duration of an unpleasant event makes it tolerable. But the author's new study contradicts this lay understanding. Rather than weakening affective episodes over time, duration knowledge actually intensifies them, rendering a positive experience more pleasurable and a negative experience more aversive, the authors explain. The article skips down. The authors conducted a lab experiment where participants listened to 30-second song clips sung either by a pop star or one of the researchers who sings abominably. They found that people who knew the duration of the experience had more intense reactions in both directions. As a sidelight here, the Wall Street Journal on the 21st of May, 2011, reports that the singer was John Mayer and the bad singer sang the exact same song. In addition, the authors found the same results for longer clips of pleasant music, Mozart, and unpleasant noise, a vacuum cleaner. The article skips down and ends with this. Duration knowledge prompts people to consider the state in which the ongoing experience terminates, an undesirable future state for pleasurable experiences and a desirable one for unpleasant experiences, the authors conclude. Now, I hate to tell you this, but this next song will last exactly 30 seconds. So, what do you know about today's featured artist, Arcade Fire? Well, this bio comes to us from www.mergerecords.com, written by Michael Barclay in July 2010. The novelist Thomas Wolfe coined the famous adage, "You can't go home again." The members of Arcade Fire know this because they've tried. But when memories of youth stem from suburbs constructed for convenience, not permanence, those childhood memories become that much harder to trace. Montreal's Arcade Fire explored the theme of neighborhoods on their 2004 breakthrough album, Funeral, chosen by Rolling Stone as the number one album of the 2000s, which is playing in the background now. In 2009, during a year off after a world tour for 2007's Neon Bible, frontman Wynn Butler received an email from an old friend he grew up with in the suburbs of Houston, Texas. He sent us a picture of him with his daughter on his shoulders at the mall around the corner from where we live, says Wynn. And the combination of seeing this familiar place and seeing my friend with his child brought back a lot of feeling from that time. I found myself trying to remember the town that we grew up in and trying to retrace as much as I could remember. At the same time, other band members of a similarly suburban origin across Canada had revisited their childhood environs and, in some cases, found there was not much left, Buildings were boarded up, if they still existed at all. New roads and rivers had magically appeared, altering a landscape that now only existed in faded photographs. When they reconvened, the first song they wrote was The Suburbs, title track, which opened today's program, by the way. We started working on the song, and once that started to sound like music, it felt like we were making an album, says Wynn. As the songs of the suburbs started to take shape, a cohesive group of songs emerged, drawing on themes of loss and renewal, of drawing inspiration from scarcity, of generations past and future, of responsibility and maturity, of hoping that something pure can last. The Suburbs, like its namesake, reveals in open space, reflections on long drives, and contemplating possibilities. There is more breadth and beauty than any previous Arcade Fire recording, featuring sparse pop, modern times, which will close out today's program, by the way, icy new wave epics, no celebration, anthemic pump, month of May, and lush balladry, suburban war. Yet they still sound hungry on hard-driving tracks like Empty Room and Ready to Start, and with lyrics decrying wasted time, arms folded tight, and cities with no children. The seven-piece band still believes that it takes a village to perform a song, but there's plenty of room to breathe on any given track. Tiny details are doled out bit by bit. That attention to detail, that refusal to accept easy answers, embodies much of what the Arcade Fire does. This fiercely independent band has faced pressure from every corner of the music industry, but carved out something beyond the grasps of the major label system with great success, a combination of internet word of mouth and old-fashioned live show impressions. "We were lucky to be left to our own devices," says Wynn. "That afforded us a lot of control over our own destiny, which a lot of bands that are my heroes either never got or only got late in their careers. We felt fortunate, because what else do you want? We're making records the way we want, and it's a great position to be in." And from Amazon.com, we see this review of Arcade Fire by Jay Loudon. Arcade Fire burst onto the scene in 2004 with their debut album, Funeral. Their grandiose indie anthems earned them glowing praise from critics and fans alike. With Wynn Butler leading on vocals and guitar, Arcade Fire's eclectic instrumentation and apparent influences, including David Bowie, Bruce Springsteen, Radiohead, and Neil Young, made them stand out from the countless indie bands getting their start at the same time. The Suburbs finds Arcade Fire taking a longing look at the naivety of their youth, while looking forward to what the future holds. Where their first two albums leaned heavily on standout singles like Wake Up or Rebellion, The Suburbs is much more of a complete work, meant to be taken in as a single hour-long journey between adolescence and adulthood. Longtime fans of Arcade Fire will always hold Funeral on a pedestal, untouchable by future releases, but just as children often grimace at being compared to their parents, The Suburbs is a masterpiece worthy of such an analogy.
Oh,
The album, The Suburbs, released in late 2010, has a deluxe edition being released next month. This extended edition features additional tracks, including the one, Culture Wars, playing in the background now. The album itself has won 2011 Grammy Award for Album of the Year, 2011 Brit Award for Best International Album, 2011 Brit Award for Best International Group, 2011 Juno Award for Album of the Year, and 2011 Juno Award for Alternative Album of the Year. Finally, in punknews.org, we find this about Durham's, North Carolina's Merge Records. Merge Records was started in the summer of 1989 by Laura Balance and Mac McCoffin. The same summer they formed the band Superchunk in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Artists with releases on the Merge label include Spoon, Superchunk, The Rosebuds, Arcade Fire, The Mountain Goats, among others. This next article comes to us from Katie Gray, entitled Music is What Carney Does, Is, and it was published in the News and Observer on the 8th of July, 2011. The other day, Gene Carney sat in on the rehearsal of a 150-voice choir that is slated to perform at Washington's Kennedy Center in mid-July. Taking in the sight and sound of those singing college kids left her awestruck. It also raised her hopes. Seeing those fledging musicians, these budding artists, gives me goosebumps. They are dedicated to music and extremely interested in music's history, says soul singer Carney, 64. Those wonderful singers are the defining factor. They will help determine how well we can produce and sustain good music. Georgia-born Carney has been making her own kind of music since she was a four-year-old standing on a wooden crate so the parishioners in her hometown church could see who was belting out a sacred song. And my mother used to say that while I was a little girl, I would give these impromptu concerts to anyone who came into the house, she says. When she performed July 9th in Raleigh, she drew on those early experiences. She offered up some of her signature songs and took special requests from people in the relatively small crowd. These intimate settings are really fun for me. I would rather work 2 days in a small setting than do a concert on a big stage where I don't get to commune and touch the people. The audience sends you vibrations, good wishes, good thoughts. It's that magical aspect of performance. Music is all about the human connection, says Carney, who gained acclaim in the 1970s and 80s with such chart toppers as Closer Than Close and Don't Let It Go to Your Head. The article skips down and ends with this. Carney also is studied. In high school, she played the bassoon, the oboe, the French horn. She was a member of the marching band. Her father played piano, and her mother sang in the choir. I had no choice as to whether I was going to sing or not. I didn't choose music. Music chose me. And she's glad that her fans remain loyal. I'm certainly grateful for that, said Carney, who also tours internationally. I've been doing this, enjoying this, for so long that my singing is special and, at the same time, not so. It's just what I do. It's my job. And a real blessing to me. This next article comes to us from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, Plunges into Music, 2007. The Story of Music, Part 3. Here's the final installment of our whirlwind tour through the history of music. Parts 1 and 2 were presented on earlier programs. The art scene. Most musicologists divide the rest of the timeline of European art music, what we commonly call classical music, into four periods: Baroque, Classical, Romantic, and Modern. Each has its own distinctive characteristics. Baroque, circa 1600 to 1760. The growth of opera, notwithstanding the Baroque period, sees instrumental music become the dominant form with the development of the sonata, which is to be sounded, as opposed to the previous century, cantata, to be sung, and concertos, compositions written for orchestras and solo instrumentalists. The classical period, circa 1750 to 1820, the classical period is characterized by a cleaning up of art of all kinds. The music becomes more reserved, detailed, and rational. Then there was the Romantic period, 1815 to 1910. Music now becomes much more dynamic and expressive, and orchestras size balloons to more than 100 players. The modern period, circa 1900 to the present, is next. Changes spurred by technology, the ability to record and play back music, the accessibility and popularity of radio and television, and the development of electronic instrument change music forever. This includes periods like the Impressionism, which went from the late 1800s to the late 1930s, Neoclassicism, this style developed between the world wars, Atonalism, Surrealism, and Indeterminism. The article skips down and ends with this: the modern timeline, with such a long history, the rules of Western music are the most popularly used ones in the world. But of course, there are many other kinds of music, each with its own histories and stories. Who knows, maybe someday we'll have 59 notes in our scale and 25 part harmonies, or we might just go back to chanting. We'll have to wait and see. So, how'd you do on those trivia questions? Question number one, which one of the following is not an actual song title? Actually, the answer is F. All of the above are actual country song titles. Mama Get a Hammer, There's a Fly on Papa's Head, Rednecks, White Sox, and Blue Ribbon Beer, She Got the Gold Mine, I Got the Shaft, Drop Kick Me, Jesus, Through the Goalposts of Life, and If You See Me Getting Smaller, It's 'Cause I'm Leaving You. And the question number two, in 1976, Rick Dees, the Memphis disc jockey, was inspired by disco, wrote a novelty song by a man who dances so hard he turns into a C. Answer C, a duck. And the title of that number one hit from 1976 was Disco Duck. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of music to feature on Rock Review, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.